But either way, I like your space. That looks cool.
Thanks.
Where is that?
This is my new studio.
Oh, cool. Ooh.
It's above the art house.
Ooh.
That's very nice. Kind of northeast facing windows, so it's like just a wonderful place to hang out, and it's really quiet up here and peaceful. Nobody's gonna like pop in and crack me.
Like the gallery.
Yeah, I'm really liking this. It's about a sixth the cost.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's significant.
It's not really open to the public.
Right.
I am open on art walks, which is basically all I was open anyways, because I could never keep regular hours. I don't know. It's all good.
That's sweet.
So, I think also, Josh, I think I'm going to change the podcast title to Theory Night Podcast.
Ooh,
I was thinking I was going to switch it back to The Lonely Painter.
Uh-huh.
But I kind of want to start hosting theory nights at the house and have fires and chili, and so that anybody who is in Billings could, that if there's any listeners in Billings that are interested in this stuff, like this would be kind of my invitation to them to reach out, to email me and then I'd have like a chili night. I'd make chili and build a fire in the fire pit. And then it'd be focused around maybe a particular chapter from like a Mari Rudy book or some other theory book. And then it would just be open discussion too. So,
oh, that would be very cool.
Yeah. I think that could be fun.
That would be awesome. I mean, honestly, it's like, do you feel like you would like go the route of you being the like kind of leader facilitator of like, this is what we're going to talk about, this is what I've prepared kind of thing?
I kind of think so, because there are very specific concepts that flow logically one to the next that I'm like, especially since reaching out to Mari and going back now and really digging into the four books of hers that I have, I see a shape to the movement of her thought, and it's important to lay certain foundations
so
that you move one to the next, and I wouldn't want to host a night that is all over the place.
Yeah.
I want it to at least start out centered around something, and then it would be open to whatever, you know, whatever people want to talk about. That's great.
But what if you did it like, my voice is definitely deeper. You're not wrong. I feel like, you know how like when you wake up some mornings and you're just like more mucosal and you're like, man, what's going on with my throat? I feel that right now. What if you did like shared homily style? Did I ever tell you about this church that I was going to for a little bit here in Seattle?
No, but I like the sound of that.
So it was an Episcopal service, and they did a mass. I really liked it for a number of different design choices, but one of those was that they did, instead of just a homily, which is usually shorter than a sermon, like 8 or 10 minutes kind of thing.
Yeah.
And usually more of a personal reflection versus like an exposition. They did, this is the only church I've ever heard of doing that. I don't think they invented it though. But they did what's called a shared homily, where one person who sometimes would be clergy and sometimes not, which I also liked that, some person would give a homily, and then they opened it up to discussion for 15 or 20 minutes as a part of the mass, which in a mass setting is like, it's like already unusual anyway, but like, like for church, but like definitely unusual for a, for a mass to do that.
That's
amazing. But I liked the style.
Yeah, I think that form is maybe closer to following Jesus than almost any other, or than most
sermon-centric services.
Yeah. Sermon-centric, one person who's been chosen by God to lead everybody.
Uh-huh.
Kind of thing. Yeah, I really like that. I mean, that's kind of, you know, of course, it's sort of like story night. It's something like that.
Right.
It's open to. And isn't there something in Acts that kind of lays out that as a possibility for form? Where doesn't it say something about like the gathering being like, I should look this up. It suggests something like when they gathered, they would eat and then they'd sit around, and as the Spirit moved, they would kind of each talk, but sort of only if the Spirit moved. And then the other people that were there would judge whether or not that was from the Spirit or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Maybe that's when he's talking about like prophecy and like spiritual gifts, maybe? That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Well,
but I feel like you're right.
Yeah. Anyways, I haven't, I don't want to talk too much about that because I am stepping into areas that I'm not super familiar with, and I'm trying in life to not talk about things that I don't really know about.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, good thing you have a podcast. No, I'm just kidding. No, I feel you. I feel like half the time someone like brings up something about the Bible, I like try to err on that side too. I'm like, well, that sounds familiar, but I'm like, I if I don't remember where it's at, I'm not gonna say it's in there.
Yeah, that's kind of, I've heard it called like I reckon type.
Oh,
or, you know,
yeah,
or type thinking. And it's kind of, I think
it's common in other areas too, like academia, just in general.
Maybe it's unavoidable. Maybe it's a necessary component of thinking, but it just needs to be held like it needs to be balanced, I think. You know, going into all of these, like, well, you sort of like quickly putting out there into the world ideas that you haven't really wrestled with and formed into something that you would stand behind and say, yep, I believe this. Rather some, you know, when we're just shooting from the hip, it can, I don't know, that can just be a little dangerous, I think.
Yeah.
But that's why, so yeah, with the, from now on, kind of on this podcast, I do want to, like in the first episode back, I tried to really stick to what I see as a foundational part of in Mari's movement of thought, which is lack, and the two forms of lack, one being constitutive and the other being contingent. And so that was what that first episode was trying to kind of lay that groundwork for that. But from here, though, once that groundwork has been laid, then I think the next movement of her thought is something like, because there is a lack within us, we have the capacity to experience something like what she calls a call or a summons. Kind of an invitation, and that when we are able to heed and hear that call, when we're able to hear and heed that call, that we as we heed that, that we actually step into kind of a vitality that we will not experience by any other means. But that in our, and then maybe the third movement would be that it's hard, for one, it's hard to hear that call, let alone heed it in a society that is constantly offering substitutionary objects that promise wholeness and completeness, but never fully satisfy, in the way that she wants to argue that there truly are certain objects, people, activities, ideas that call to us, that really do contain what she would call an echo of the thing, capital T thing, an echo of that. And it's just that it's really hard to, it's an art to be able to make space to hear that call, let alone have the courage to heed it. But that she's arguing that basically when we do, we kind of experience maybe eternal life, might be it might be a similar notion. So but that yeah, anyways. I'm not, well, I think I'm doing a decent job of articulating those thoughts.
No, it sounds interesting. Where do you think the line is in, like, because, like, you kind of made fun of earlier the trope of just, like, rambling opinions that, like, haven't been thought out, or, like,
yeah, making
solidified in any way. Yeah, just like idle talk, or like, yeah, I reckoning.
Yeah.
But like, I could see the criticism going the other way, in that, like, I think a lot of people see theory in that way, like whether it's theology or philosophy or feminism or like whatever type of theory we're talking about. And I think that it like gets this rap of like, well, it's just theory. You're just like,
that's all just irreal statements. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So that's where I actually do want to ask her, okay, what evidence is there for, seeing the world in this way? And I would say, I'm not sure if she would say this, but I would say that parapraxis is the evidence for it.
Parapraxis as in like our lived experience, right?
Parapraxis is slips of the tongue, dreams and nightmares.
Oh.
Those moments in which we say, in which we say something or we do something and we go, oh my God, like, that's not me. Those moments where we feel other to ourselves. That would be an example of parapraxis. So other, I would say that it kind of get it, that psychoanalytic theory, I think that's where it kind of cuts its teeth. And I'm not sure that other theories, philosophies, ideologies contend with that in the way that psychoanalytic theory does, with that phenomena that we cannot deny because those things happen, right? And so that would be maybe one of the groundworks, like kind of foundational pieces of evidence that we then kind of start to theorize out of. The other, let's see, what would be the other thing would be, I mean, just sort of this idea of lack is not, it is a topic that has been, it's been in philosophy now for like the last 100 years, the nothingness at the core of being, Sartre, existentialism, all of that is wrestling with this. So it's just that I'm not sure though that he really wrestles with parapraxis as much, but he does sort of just posit that there is, there is, well, his whole thing is, right, that there is no essence to who human beings, there is no essence to humans, to human beings, that being, that being precedes essence is kind of his big thing, which means that we are the nothingness around which we put beings, and beings being things like our names, our symbolic identification, which is our names, which is our outward appearance, but at the core of all of that, the argument is that there is no essential thing other than the lack of an essential thing. But that lack is what causes us as humans to reach out with questions like, what does it mean to be human? How ought I live my life? Because that's not a given. We are called, summoned into the potential of making meaning in our lives as we heed the call of I feel like, yeah, I don't know if I'm making sense or not, but
no, I think so. I think I see what you're saying.
I'm gonna grab some more wine.
It's 1 o'clock somewhere.
So, but I think that parapraxis is or something like a joke also is something that I find clues me in to, I think I kind of put jokes and parapraxis on the same level, or they're in a similar category for me, because if parapraxis, like a slip of the tongue, I say one thing and yet mean another, I myself am surprised something unexpected pops up that I didn't see coming. That's parapraxis. That's a slip of the tongue. In the same way that a joke all of a sudden elicits laughter, there is something truthful in that. So it's following that thread. I think that those things like jokes and parapraxis are the evidence for the legitimacy of something like psychoanalytic theory.
But isn't that just because of the like focus on the unconscious, and that's what psychoanalytics is trying to deal with? Right. As opposed to like the I guess I would say that I think idle talk quote unquote, like the eye reckoning of people thinking they're saying something profound when they're, it may or may not be true what they're like saying in the moment. I think that that's more conscious. Like, even though that's like, not that there can't be those unconscious like slips of the tongue, but I think that people, I think that it almost makes me want to say that like theory without idle talk is dead. Like, it starts there. I think it starts with people starting to formulate and saying out loud the things that they think they think. And by saying those things out loud, then they can test whether or not that is true in their experience. And then that then leads us to like more robustness, in my opinion. So like, I could see someone making the case for like conscious, like that being like the more, like more of a route of like your conscious versus like your unconscious mind. And I feel like the parapraxis thing is getting at the unconscious.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe that would be, maybe this whole thing, what you're saying there, would be an argument against sort of what I was saying before. About being sort of, before I was kind of saying that I'm against, I reckon type conversations mm-hmm. in a public way. But you're right, though, that it is kind of, we only kind of come to know what we believe through working it out verbally. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of analysis is that you go into analysis and it's the talking cure, and that, and you lay back on the couch and they're behind you and you're talking and they're not giving advice. They're listening for the hesitations, the slips of the tongue, that kind of thing. The unconscious isn't some deep buried subconscious thing. The unconscious is on the surface in our very speech, in the times where we disavow something. We say, no offense, Josh, but I think that I think that you're completely wrong. Or yeah. The saying of no offense is reveals the truth that in some sense I do want to offend you.
Right. The negation.
So the uncalled for disavowal, the unprompted disavowal reveals the truth of the desire within the speaking subject. And so that's why the unconscious isn't like a deep like thing that I can dig down to. It's right there on the surface.
That's a good way to put that.
Yeah. That's one way of thinking of it. The other thing though too is there is all of these repressed, like repression is a real thing, and so I reckon that there's a lot more to kind of say on that, but I guess in these podcast episodes that I'm going to do, I'm just going to try to slowly work through different parts of Mari's work without, I think anyways, I mean, maybe I won't, maybe it's just that I remember in the past doing my podcast and I would kind of free associate, and maybe that was good to some extent, but I worry that I might be putting out into the world, ideas that are not fully fleshed out, and that
totally
there's a danger in that. Like, that's sort of irresponsible.
Like, do you see that danger mostly in like affecting other people, or like in affecting your future self, or both, or like solidifying ideas in you now that like have ramifications that are unknown, or?
Yeah, I think all of those.
Totally. Okay. Well, maybe let me share a different perspective. So like I'm doing Ravel, right? And like our whole shtick is like real time theological thinking. Like the other people in the room don't know what we're going to talk about other than the person who's bringing a question or a starting point.
Yeah.
And we go from there. And I think for a lot of the things that we talk about, because it's like, it's theological in nature and like we're all interested in it. Like it's usually about things that we have thought about before, or like we maybe have an opinion on. But one thing that I've found is that I think a lot of the time we are often like either saying things for the first time, like out loud, or we're like coming to new opinions in the moment, even whether that's like in ourselves or like because of each other. And I don't find myself having the same fear of like what if this is not the right opinion, or like the like as thought out as I could be, or even do I want this opinion? To me, it feels more like what's the right word? I almost want to use the word inauthentic, but I think that that term gets so like pacified these days. But to me, it feels more like to me, it feels more similar to that kind of like conscious idle talk processing that like is necessary to think things out. And I think that many people just don't even allow themselves to do that.
Yeah.
And like I can recognize, and like we've even like talked about this a little bit, which feels a little meta on the pod, of like saying an opinion and then being like, I might disagree with myself in 5 years. Like I might listen back on this and maybe cringe, but also I might just like straight up deny my reasons for believing that now.
Yeah.
And I find something like very human about that. And what's funny is like, maybe I'll just like disagree with this take in the future as well. Like maybe I will like more agree with you in the future.
Yeah.
But I find something very human about that, of like being able to like see someone's like change over time, whether it's my own or like someone else's. Or
and the funny thing is we're doing it right now. Like
totally. Yeah, absolutely.
You're kind of convincing me a little bit.
Right. Yep.
I don't know. Maybe it's,
but I get the concern, because there is so much like, there are so many terrible and harmful opinions out there that are like being projected out into the world. But I also think that like, social media is a great example, actually. I think a lot of people like to hate on some certain things that happen in discourse on social media, whether it's like celebrities or like bad information being like elevated just because of like algorithmic things. And then like actual experts like trying to speak to something and just getting like their voices getting like demolished because like people don't want to agree with them on whatever it is. But I think that like a lot of these things like do get self-corrected, because like the more voices that are out there, like sure, some things may get amplified in the moment and might like end up causing things that like cause real tangible harm, whether it's like psychological or physical, or to like one person or many. But in my opinion, like I also see like a lot of like correction out there of like, this is a bad take, or like, I used to believe this and now I don't anymore. And here's just my perspective, and I'm not telling you to change your mind, but I changed my mind, or like things like that. And I think that I don't think it's a complete free exchange of ideas, because social media is like its own thing right now. But I don't think that's bad. Like, I think that it's, it might depend on the platform and like how effective that like idea correction is. But like,
yeah,
I see that as leading to theory, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and that the back and forth, the putting it out there so as to get some distance from it, so that you can then critique it either yourself, or certainly you'll be critiqued by others once it's out there, allows for that movement maybe towards truth.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, maybe you're convincing me, Josh. Yeah. Well, this is good. I mean, I just, maybe I like this.
I think it's very valuable. Like, to your point, I do think it's valuable to like put something like making sure that the things that you're putting out into the world are excellent or complete, yeah, or like, I feel like that's like super relevant for like the art world, right? Like, of course things develop over time, but like, you're not going to just like produce bad art just for the sake of putting it out there.
Yeah. Okay, so let's set some of this eye reckoning aside. Did you ever read anything by Mari Rudy? We were roommates for years, and do you remember me ever reading her work when we were?
I don't think so. That the name doesn't sound familiar to me when you were talking about it on that episode.
Okay. Well, she just she is right there, like on the level with Zizek. Mm. I mean, her work engages critically back, and she and Zizek are, you know, go back and forth.
Mm.
They, I would say, are parallel in thought. I feel like I do know Mari's work better than I know Zizek's work. She's a much more clear writer than Zizek. So it, like, for anybody who likes Zizek or is intrigued by Zizek, but also maybe kind of can't, I feel like a lot of times people don't find him incomprehensible. Like, you can't understand what he's getting at.
Mm.
And also he tends to be polemic. He tends to push people's buttons. Mm. Or some people just say, I can't stand the way he talks. Like, he has certain tics that he can't help, and he kind of has a little bit of a speech impediment.
Mm-hmm.
I would really recommend people go look into Mari Rudy's work, because for 90% of it, she and Zizek are aligned. Where they differentiate, from what I've heard her articulate, is the ways in which Zizek tends to favor the death drive as a place for emancipatory collective potential, and Mari is less, she's hesitant to valorize what would be in that school maybe called subjective destitution, or like giving oneself so completely over to something that it ends to maybe a form of martyrdom. She's like, okay, wait a minute. Like, let's, in order to change a system, maybe the best way to do that is to follow one's desire and to be creative and to be an artist in some way. I would say, like, a comedian, to think about how can maybe substantive change within systems comes through indirect communication, and that would mean that it's not necessary that one becomes a martyr, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But now I am kind of stepping into ground that I am not totally certain of, so I should probably not talk about that. So, but she, the specificity of desire is in her work and the ethics of the summons of love is some of the most hopeful. It's so amazing, man. Like you got, you should, sometime you got to read The Call of Character.
The Call of Character?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me add that to my list here.
The ending, the last chapter of it, I was reading it and yesterday I was just going, oh my God, this is the most beautiful. This is the most beautiful, thing I've like ever read. So
cool. Living a life worth living. So would you say that she is a philosopher? Do you feel like that's a fair characterization?
Yeah. She draws a lot from Nietzsche, some from Sartre, and then a ton from Lacan, and I think also quite a bit from Emmanuel Levinas, who I'm not familiar with him, but the little bit that I've come across him as a reference in other articles, I'm like, oh man, that guy is somebody I would like to look more into in the future.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Some of her other books look really interesting as well.
I think potentially another title for The Call of Character could be something like maybe like The Art of Taming Jouissance.
Hmm.
Let me ask you this, Josh. Do you experience moments in your life where you have this overexcitation within your body, and like where there's this almost, it could be thought of as like anxiety, but on one level it has the potential like that you could direct that into some kind of a creative endeavor, or you could go and kind of get rid of that by like over drinking. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you mean like a spontaneous drive to take action kind of thing, or like I feel like I've totally felt that before. Or even if it's like, even if it's not something in the moment, if it's like if it's like a thing that I want to start doing, and I'm like, one of my friends calls it the juice that you like really feel the juice for. And to me, I do think that there is something that feels different versus like me thinking about something and I'm like, oh, I want to get into that, or I want to like learn more about that. Like that's interesting to me versus like, I have an idea that like won't leave me alone.
Exactly.
And I'm like, oh my God, I could do this. Or like, I want this to exist kind of thing.
Yep.
I've totally felt that. I mean, none of it's like been like mass, like massive or anything, but like, I know I think I've totally felt that before.
Okay. So that, I think this is what I'm interested in talking with her about. I think that she's advocating for an art, a cultivation of an ability to know how to sit in that intensity and to direct that in creative endeavors, into creative endeavors. To hear and to heed that call. And often, but often it's scary to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a cultivation of courage it's so much easier to go and, you know, get some alcohol and just repress that call.
Mm.
Just go, you know what? Or to turn on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I think she's saying, if you want to have a life worth living, this is an art that you're going to need to wrestle with.
Mm. Does she mean it in like specifically in terms of creating things, whatever those things are?
It could be that. It could also be as simple as, I think, remaining faithful to whatever it is that seems to call to us, that even if we can't fully grasp it, we remain open to that. In a recent talk talks about how she found these three rings in some store, and she's not somebody who purchases very many things. She lives a pretty sparse as far as commodities go, like pretty sparse existence.
Mm-hmm.
But she was at this store, and these two rings seemed to call out to her. She was, as in her words, summoned by them.
Hmm.
And she went and bought those rings, and then she couldn't get out of her mind this third ring.
Hmm.
So she had to go back and get the third ring. And she says, now, I know that unless somebody gives me another ring, I think she means like unless I fall in love and end up getting married, she goes, these are the three rings the only rings that I will ever have for the rest of my life. So she's saying that there is something to a specificity of desire and remaining faithful to the specificity of desire that within a certain genre can, when we are faithful to that, it can free us from what she calls the metonymy of the signifier, or this always constantly looking for the next thing that will be the satisfying object that fills in the lack within me.
Mm.
But that rather, I remain faithful to my love for this person. And because I'm faithful to that, I no longer am constantly looking for the perfect something out there. In the same way, I kind of think of this like even with the Yale house or the Christmas house that I live in.
Mm-hmm.
In a society that, and even a lot of my friends, not a lot of my friends, but a few of my friends who say like, are you going to buy a house, Tyler? Like, you know, you're this age, like kind of would make sense to own a house. I'm beginning to realize that, no, there's something about that house that I feel called to.
Mm.
And even though I can't own that house, or I don't even know that I feel called to own a house.
Yeah.
I feel called to currently investigate Mari Rudy's books.
Mm.
I feel called currently to maybe try to create Theory Night. I feel called currently, currently I don't really feel called to paint. Like, I think that will come back to me. Like, I'm in my studio here, and I actually do have to get to work. So I have things coming up that I'm going to have to get back to. But I know that there, and even me reaching out to Mari was potentially me remaining faithful to a call within me.
Mm.
In the same way, like I remember I used to lay in bed and look, stare into the dark of the night in high school, thinking about the next day, how I would be performing at a speech and drama competition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be laying there and my body would just be like electric.
Mm.
Coursing with jouissance. Coursing with this too muchness. But the next day I would direct that into that performance.
Mm.
And we were awesome. Like we were so good. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I've totally felt the like almost uncalling too, as it were.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
I think I've felt it in various ways before, that are sometimes like religious in nature, like wanting to invest in a certain community or like not invest in a community anymore. Sure. But I've also felt it. I think often the like calling and uncallings often coincide. Like, for instance, I used to like really feel the juice to hosting Beerlosophy like once a week for like over 2 years, pretty much. And that happened to coincide with me feeling the uncalling of that happened to coincide with me feeling called to move. Like, I mean, obviously there was like lots of factors in moving as well, but like feeling this like unexpected call all of a sudden that I felt like I had to answer, or I had the choice to answer whether or not I was going to heed that. And then like, as a result of that, I don't feel, maybe not as a result of it, but like coincidentally, I don't feel that same call to host Beerlosophy, or like, I don't have the same call to, but so, I mean, like part of it's like, I think there's like so many factors that like can be pointed to, even if you're like, not just to like explain it, but like, oh, like I don't live in that place anymore. Or so like, of course I don't want to do X anymore because I can't. Or it's not going to be in the same way. But I've totally felt that before, I think. Like, whether I've like remained in the same physical place or not, I think that the uncalling, or like another example, I mean, I like doing the Billings Beat before, and then like moving. And like, so like on one hand you could explain it as like, well, he doesn't live here anymore. So of course he like he's not thinking about it, or he doesn't want to like do it about a community he's not a part of, which all might be true. But like at the end of it, I like don't feel the call.
Yep.
Like that's what it's like. But that, I think that like something like that could happen, like regardless of other factors too. Like maybe if I like still lived in Billings, at a certain point, I probably wouldn't feel the call anymore.
Yeah. Yep.
And it'd probably be like a little bit less explainable. I'd just be like, well, I don't feel it like for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes the reasons for it, like calls or uncalling, like do make themselves known. And I think sometimes they don't, but I think that you're right. That like there's a certain special nature to like choosing to heed your gut on something.
Yeah. I mean, would you say that when you decided to heed the call to Seattle,
mm-hmm.
I imagine there was a certain anxiety, but a good kind of an anxiety. Like,
oh yeah. Life, oh, 100%.
Electric feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was like, to me, it felt like one of those moments, which not that this makes it any more valid, but to me, it felt like one of those moments of like, if I don't do this, I know I'm going to forever ask myself the question, what if I did do this?
Yeah. Yep.
Which, of course, that doesn't like make it like any better of a choice necessarily. Like that they could have not worked out. Like, and I mean, in many ways, it didn't work out the way I expected to. So, I mean, like you could say it didn't work out, but yeah. But in a lot of ways it did. Like in a lot of ways it like went better than I expected too. So it's like, I think that when we heed the call to something, like I think that we often have an expectation of like what's going to happen, and we cannot in my opinion, we cannot rate the success of the call by compared to what we expected would happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, heeding the call might lead us into absolute heartbreak.
Yeah, 100%.
And yet, I think we have to do it. Like, or,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that I would rather err on the side of heeding it than trying to play my life in a safe way.
Yeah. I would agree. Have you ever felt like there was something that you wanted to heed, but you like felt like you couldn't, either because of like time or money or like ability or like something that you like felt a call towards, but like felt like in that moment of feeling the call, you could not follow it?
No, nothing comes to mind in the sense that some external obstacle got in the way. But I would say that there have been times where I have been unfaithful to the call. And have given up on something and gone in, or, you know, just even, I would say that for me, feeling this, I must do something kind of feeling, often the way, and yet not having the courage to do that, often the way I have dealt with that is by either overeating or over drinking. But I've also done that also with going after certain things that weren't what I really wanted, because I was too afraid to just be honest about what I really wanted.
What do you think is the main distinction between the calling of something and a desire for something? Or does Mari make any distinction there?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to think through. So the calling for something and the desire. I think that true desire aligns itself with the echo of the thing, which is the call or the summons. Whereas there is something about, I think I've heard like a distinction between desire and wanting. And so I think there, maybe it's like either you're being faithful to the call or you're settling for a counterfeit object. A counterfeit thing that isn't really what you long for, which is like potentially maybe like the same as calling it idolatry. But maybe we should wrap it up, Josh. I don't know if you have any other last thoughts, but we've been going for a while.
I don't think I have any other last thoughts that are like super conclusive about things that I reckon, other than I do think that the idea of calling is very compelling. And I think that it's a very I don't know if Mari's right about it or not. I don't know how to test it, but like I feel compelled by the idea of like ideas that won't leave me alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe that's another bit of like, it's the kind of evidence that you can't test in a lab.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the thing about philosophy and theory and psychoanalysis is it's not like a hard science where you can, it's so relative to the person in question.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's why a lot of people don't take it seriously. Or a lot of, yeah, it's not provable. It's, it's just something that tends to insist.
I think it's interesting. I mean, I think it gets criticized. It gets a bad rap for being unprovable, but I think it's super interesting, stuff like that.
It's stuff like, I mean, even, you know, when I first got into this stuff, it was like I listened to a talk by Peter Rollins, who I think maybe has influenced you in some way. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Hmm. Anyways, I listened to a talk by Peter Rollins. And I mean, honestly, if you want to understand Peter Rollins better, you should read Mari.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Mari is more, I mean, I remember having the sense that, oh, everything that Rollins is saying comes from Mari. The more I read Zizek, which I haven't read a ton of Zizek, oh, everything that Peter Rollins is saying comes from Zizek.
Like, that's so funny.
Yeah. It's, like all the jokes all come from Zizek, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the joke about the, you know, the guy who goes to an analyst because he thinks he's a seed. Do you remember that joke?
No, I haven't heard that one.
Okay. Well, okay. So maybe to wrap up what I was starting to say about Rollins was I remember probably 7 years ago or something, I was introduced to Rollins through Matt Blakeslee. Mm-hmm. He recommended I maybe give him a listen. And all of a sudden I'm just like, good Lord, like this guy is calling out to me. I feel summoned by this, although I couldn't articulate it in that way. But there's just something about what he was saying that I was like, shit, like I don't know what the hell this guy has just said for the last 10 minutes, but I for some reason maybe it's the Irish accent, maybe it's the jokes, whatever. I have to investigate further.
Yeah.
And okay, so anyways, one of the jokes that, and the more I investigated, the more it led to Slavoj Žižek, Todd McGowan, Mari Rudy. And Rudy is the most, the one that you can actually like pick up her book and follow
what she's saying.
Okay. So, but yeah, so the joke that Rollins talks about is, the guy who goes to an analyst and thinks he's a seed. Uh-huh. He thinks he's a piece of seed, and he thinks that he's terrified that he's going to be eaten by chickens.
Okay.
Okay, so he goes there, and after months of analysis, the analyst finally helps him to believe that, you know what, I'm not a piece of seed. I'm a human being. And so finally he's able to leave an analysis. And the next day he comes back and he's all anxiety ridden and like terrified. And the analyst is like, but you know, you're not, like, we've been through this. You know, you're a human being. You know, you're not a seed. And the man says to the analyst, I know I'm not a piece of seed, but does the chicken know I'm not a piece of seed?
That's funny.
Okay, so in order to understand, like, that joke is really key to, if you understand that joke, it unlocks a lot of Zizek. That disavowal and disavowed beliefs and disavowed enjoyment is, that's what the chickens are in that joke. What are the chickens? The chickens are disavowed belief, disavowed enjoyment. Which, yeah, that's a huge, what is disavowed enjoyment? We'll leave that for another podcast.
I knew you were going to say something like that. That's funny.
That's, yeah, yeah. So, anyways, Josh, I love you, man. And
me too. It's good to chat with you.
Yeah. Let's talk more.
We should.
It doesn't have to be a,
I would love that.
It doesn't have to be a recorded podcast.
No, I would love that. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah. And thanks for helping me with this.
Yeah, I hope it goes well. I bet that'll be really fun, if not profound, getting to interview a favorite author like that, that you like want to understand more. That'd be super cool.
Well, yeah, and I hope that it will be a way for me to direct friends here in Billings to this interview and say, like, and just perhaps it'll spark some interest.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be kind of like a beacon for anybody here in Billings to, like, let's get together and let's talk about this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that would be very cool. So, as good conversation should lead to more conversation.
All right, man.
Well, I hope it goes well.
Thanks.
Hopefully Zencastr is more of a help than a hurt.
If you get into, if you read one of her books, let me know. Penis Envy is also incredible.
That looked really interesting.
It's, yeah, she, that's, you know what, maybe start with that.
Okay.
It would be in the genre of auto theory. And she does a really good job of presenting what neoliberalism is.
Oh.
And biopolitics. She brings in Foucault. She does a really good job of explaining these two different forms of lack.
Huh.
All of that.
The Case for Falling in Love looks really interesting too.
That one is incredible. It's the most accessible book.
Interesting.
It's written to women, and it's a takedown of gender binaryism. It's actually kind of a takedown of essentialism.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. That,
okay.
Men, you know, men are this way, women are this way.
Gotcha. Kind of. That makes sense. Very cool. I'm going to check those out. I really need to get back on the reading train. Last year was not a big reading year for me. And I really want to read more. I'm like,
What was it a year for?
It was, oh, I like that question. That's a great question. I think
you called
overall
summit.
I think overall it was a year for, that was such a thoughtful question. I've like mentioned the reading thing several times, and it usually just gets like passed by as like an observation, but I really liked the way you turned that around.
I am not your average, I'm not your average duck. All right.
I like changing analogies. Just the other day, I said I don't have a bear in that fight.
All right.
And I liked it. I thought it was hilarious. So I like I'm not your average duck. I think overall, in terms of like byproduct, it was a year for growing closer with Elise, getting adjusted to living together and like enjoying a new like side of each other and like a new form of relationship, like being so proximal.
Yeah.
I think it was a year for that. And it was really wonderful. All things considered, worth not reading. So that's yeah, it was a good year. It was a year full of other things too, but yeah.
But that was it. Yeah, I like that.
It was definitely the highlight for sure.
Good. She seems lovely from hearing her voice before we started recording.
She is. She's really wonderful. She's very cool.
Love you, Josh. And I'll talk to you later.
Love you too, man. Good luck recording. Can't wait to listen to it.
Okay, bye.
Cheerio.
Like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, if you're interested in attending a theory night at my house, we'll have I'll cook up some chili and either build a fire or we'll hang out inside in my living room, and we'll talk about some of this stuff. If you're interested in that, if you're around the Billings area and you could come over, just send me an email. My email is tylermurphyart@gmail.com. And here, maybe in the next month or two, we'll try to host something for the first time. Thanks for listening.